You are back with the conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. This is Catherine Cruz. Negotiators for both the Hawaii Nurses Association and Hawaii Pacific Health will try one more time to avert a walkout by some 700 nurses at Kapiolani Medical Center. We talked to HNA's Daniel Ross this morning about the sticking points in the labor dispute. The two sides will meet with a federal mediator Wednesday morning. The nurses have been working without a contract since November. The union says it saw a 96% turnout for its strike vote this weekend, with 93% of its members voting to strike.
It's an indication of how strongly the nurses feel. You know, you don't get turnout numbers like that if there's not a problem within the hospital. It's like management needs to address the issues. Why are the nurses so unhappy that they're willing to strike, especially at a time like this, which has been brought up multiple times? It's like clearly there are some major issues that they need to address. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had so many people voting and so many people voting yes. It's like the numbers are kind of astounding to me. I was surprised. I was confident we would have a good majority. I didn't think it'd be that good.
What are the sticking points with the talks?
Yeah, so we're still going on packages. So they had offered something that we might be able to accept on PPE, but only with other strings attached. So it's like, probably on everything they've made offers or were close enough that it would go, but it's like they're putting other strings with it and in their package deals. So right now the committee is debating, because I've seen reports on the radio that, oh, it's official, the nurses are striking. That's incorrect. We have authority to call a strike now. We have not given the notice of a strike at this point. And the committee is debating that at this time, whether they should do it now. I mean, there's a contingent that says, heck with them. They've been, we have no faith in them. We just want to call the strike now already, give the 10-day notice now. And then there's another contingent that's like, we'll give them a chance to respond on Wednesday and go from there. And if it's not a good response, if it's not an appropriate response, then we can escalate it to that. But, we'd like to de-escalate this whole thing. It's like, I don't want to see a strike happen. It's not going to be good for anybody. And we can come to terms. The minor things that are still on the table is the PPE. I mean, they're not minor things, but the things that are still in there is the PPE issues are still there. We haven't come to agreement on that. We're very close. They've said things that would be acceptable. And then on the wage and the health insurance are the other issues. And then there's an issue on PTO, which is their version. They don't have vacation and sick time. They have PTO, and it's put in one bank. You get sick, you can burn all your vacation. On that one, it's, the issues are how you sign up for it. Not how much you get. So there's issues on how you sign up for the PTO. So they had tried to make it a more fair, more equitable, because the way that management had it going before, people without seniority weren't getting enough approved. And so we tried to get a more equitable way of doing it, which management was agreed to until we did our information pickets. And then to punish them, they took it back on that and said that we're going to implement the old one that they started. Sign up for the annual PTO based on the old unfair process.
I don't think anybody wants to see a walkout, particularly during the middle of a pandemic like this. I know the
Correct.
Hospital has said that they're using the guidelines issued by the CDC when it comes to personal protective gear.
Which has the line of truth to it. That's the bare minimum that you have to do. If you do less than that, you're going to get sued. And what the guidelines say is it's emergency use authorization. It's not saying this is the best way to do it. The best way to do it was single use and do it. It's saying because the CDC recognized back in the spring that there was an emergency in the supply chain on the N95s, here's an acceptable way to deal with that. It's not saying this is the way you should be going forward. They're like, oh, we're worried about the supply chain altering again. Well, nobody else in the state is doing that. It's like, of course, everybody's watching it, and we'd be fine with if it did start to falter to reuse. But currently, the N95s are readily available. It's they're making that up. to say that it's worried about the society. They're doing it because of money. It's all about money to them.
At the same time, though, you know, they've seen a drop in their revenues. They're offering to give the nurses a pay raise.
So they have seen a drop in their revenues, and they like to say they lost money. They haven't lost money. They haven't made as much money as they were anticipating making. They're in the black. They're making money. They're not losing money. They didn't hit the goals that they had set. They made a lot less money than they had expected to make.
Well, if there is a walkout, what's the snapshot?
We're trying to avoid that happening, obviously, as we stated. You know, when we give the 10-day notice, we're going to have to go, you know, work day and night to get our logistics planned out on how to do it and how to address it.
Well, how are you staffed?
The hospital is announcing, saying straight out, that they're not going to have any problem with staffing. They've been saying it, so... You know, ask them. They're the ones saying that it's not going to be a problem. We've got it covered.
Well, here on Oahu, we've got Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children. We've got Straub and Palimomi.
So those are the HPH facilities, and then there's Wilcox on Kauai. So this is, each one has its own contract. So this is only Kapi'olani. Now, the policies are HPH policies, and they apply pretty much across the board to all of them. But these negotiations are only for Kapi'olani. We're not talking about Wilcox or Straub walking out. This would be, or Palimomi. Palimomi is non-union. This is only Kapi'olani. And we would hope that anything that as far as PPE policies, changes that they make, would apply throughout their system. They're usually pretty consistent about applying those things throughout their system. But it wouldn't be required. It wouldn't be part of the contract. This contract is only to do with Kapi'olani.
So just to be real clear, if the Hawaii Nurses Association decides to walk, it would only affect Kapi'olani?
Correct.
Could you, or are you barred from doing a sympathy strike?
We are barred. All of our contracts have no picketing and no strike clauses. So that means that it's only when a contract is expired that we can do any of that. So yes, we would be barred from picketing or striking at other facilities. That's in our contracts.
So depending on how things go Wednesday, you could be filing a 10-day notice on the strike, but the next day?
Yes, I would think so. You know, and as I said, the committee, because I don't know if people really understand the hierarchy of how things work within the union. I don't tell them what to do. We're there to provide structure, to provide the voice, you know, to be the lead like that. The committee of nurses makes the decisions. We try to guide them. We provide the structure like that. But it's not my call. It's like, technically, yes, I have to approve it, but we've got the members have to vote first. Then the executive board has to vote and say that they authorize it, which they've done. So both the members and the executive board. And so technically, by the rules, I could call it, but that's not how it works. The committee is the one who's going to make that decision. And it's committee of the nurses working at Kapi'olani. And they are the ones who are going to make the decision if and when to issue the strike notice.
Well, I believe you were around for the last time we had HNA walk out. Back then, it was, I guess, more hospitals involved.
Yes. Well, I was a rank and file member working at Queens at that time. And I believe Kuakini and St. Francis went out at the same time. But I wasn't involved in the union at that time, so I'm not positive on my facts of it. I had the perspective of any other nurse working and walking the picket line. And it's a very different situation. That was an open-ended strike. You know, we went out and we stayed out for a long time. And it was bad for everybody. And you don't see those in healthcare nowadays, open-ended strikes. And what we have authorization, what was on the ballot that they voted on to authorize a strike, was to go out for up to 7 days. So we wouldn't plan on staying out for more than 7 days. So that would be up to the committee if they decided that it was necessary to issue the notice and to go for how long. It could be for less than 7 days. That would be a decision that the committee makes. One thought would be, oh, well, what's the good if it's just 7 days, management just ride out and go? Well, then you can call another one, but we'd have to have another vote. Eventually, we'll get a deal. Eventually, some sort of an agreement will be made. I think this should be the wake-up call for management that this many nurses were so dissatisfied they're willing to do this that they need to do some changes in how things are run from management side. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, you know, we're going to be repeating this in 3 years.
That was Daniel Ross, head of the Hawaii Nurses Association. Kapi'olani Medical Center CEO Martha Smith issued this statement yesterday. She disputes the notion that they are bargaining in bad faith. HPH offered a 5% pay raise over the three-year contract, even though it has seen a $21 million drop in revenue since the pandemic start. Smith said that as a women's and children's hospital, it generally has not seen the severe COVID-19 cases like other acute care hospitals. It has had two positive patients in December. The statement says the hospital will take all steps necessary to ensure patient care at Kapi'olani will not be affected in the unfortunate event of a strike. Again, the two sides meet with the federal mediator Wednesday at 9:30 a.m.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from UH Manoa's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with virtual courses such as art, film, history, and gardening. Classes begin Tuesday, January 19th. More by searching Osher Hawaii.
What's it like to get vaccinated for coronavirus? With all the talk about the COVID shot, does it cause any major side effects? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with a doctor who has been exposed to COVID and has had the shot. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're waxing nostalgic about trains, specifically about the time when railroads crisscrossed the islands. On Hawaii Island in the first half of the 20th century, you could ride the scenic express that ran along the Hamakua coast and offered spectacular views of the ocean, cliff sides with plunging waterfalls, and the dense vegetation along the shoreline. The tracks ran across trestle bridges over deep ravines, and passengers who had the nerve were invited to get out and admire the breathtaking vista when the scenic express stopped in the middle. The train had carpeted cabins with wicker furniture and a menu that included clear soup served in a teacup, fresh fruit, and pot roast. Fresh food, gracious service, and not a plastic utensil in sight. What a way to travel. This morning, we're looking for the name of the railroad line. Think you know? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which represents real estate businesses committed to supporting affordable housing statewide, along with civic and community initiatives for residents. Learn more at NareitHawaii.com.
The Hawaii man arrested in connection with last week's armed riot at the U.S. Capitol made his first appearance in federal court today. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has been following developments and joins us now. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what is Nick Oakes charged with?
Yeah, Nick Oakes, and as you mentioned, this is the founder of the Oahu chapter of the Proud Boys, which is a far-right political organization that has been labeled an extremist hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's charged with unlawful entering of federal property, in this case the U.S. Capitol, in connection with last week's armed riot at the U.S. Capitol. several social media posts from Oak's own accounts and an interview with CNN placed him at the Capitol during the armed riot, which NPR is describing as a pro-Trump insurrection. And based on that evidence, a federal judge in Washington, D.C. approved a warrant for Oak's arrest last week, and the FBI detained him at the Honolulu airport when he was returning from D.C., when he arrived back on Oahu. He spent the weekend in the federal detention center near the airport, and this morning made his first court appearance in federal court in Honolulu. The hearing was done over the phone remotely. He's, as I mentioned, facing a misdemeanor charge of unlawfully entering the U.S. Capitol. The hearing this morning was pretty short, just about 15 minutes. It was a very initial thing just to lay out the charges, make sure that the defendant is aware of the charges facing them, and to see how they'll proceed. Oakes was released on a $5,000 bond by the judge. He's restricted to the island of Oahu and travel to the District of Columbia solely for the purposes of the court proceedings. But his lawyer did mention that those proceedings, as of right now, are expected to be held remotely due to COVID-19 concerns. So it's unlikely that he'll be traveling for the foreseeable future.
Is there any indication that he's going to make bail today and walk?
The indicators from the judge was that Oakes is expected to leave sometime today, tomorrow at the latest. It is worth noting that the U.S. attorney prosecuting the case from the District of Columbia was seeking to have Oakes barred from participating in political activity and rallies, and also to have him barred from the Capitol grounds, the U.S. Capitol grounds, while this process plays out. Judge declined to issue any kind of ruling like that today. And the case is being transferred to the district court, the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. So the proceedings will be handled by a judge in Washington, not here in Hawaii.
Okay, but I know he does have a Honolulu attorney, Miles Briner, as his defense lawyer. So he's handled many high-profile cases. And so I know you'll continue to track this one. But thanks so much, Ryan.
Sure thing, Catherine.
That was HPR's Ryan Finnerty, who has been following the Nick Oakes story. You may recall that Nicholas Oakes ran unsuccessfully for a state House seat representing Waikiki under the Republican Party banner in 2020. HPR's Noe Tanigawa was the first to report that Oakes had started a Hawaii chapter of Proud Boys here in the islands. Here's her interview from January 2018.
Meet Nick Oakes, former Trump Hawaii campaign co-chair and president and founder of Proud Boys Hawaii.
We are a social club, a fraternity. Proud Boys are what you would call the new right, or to make it simpler to understand, the alt-light.
Oakes says, contrary to media reports, they did not have anything to do with events in Charlottesville and are not racist.
The only thing you have to do to become a Proud Boy is declare yourself to be a proud Western chauvinist. It's just to say that we think Western culture is the best, and we need make no apology for that.
What is Western culture, then?
Western culture, the first world.
Who is that, anyway?
America, first and foremost. We're an American chapter, and we think this is the greatest country on Earth.
United States.
Canada, Western Europe, yeah. Let's not overcomplicate this. What's today's big controversy? The president is in trouble for, I know you have polite listeners, calling certain parts of the world crap holes, specifically Haiti, right?
Africa.
And Africa, sure. Objectively, these countries do not have anywhere near the standard of living that countries in the West do. Everyone agrees that Haiti is a crap hole. I think speaking honestly is just speaking honestly. And the fact that a controversy erupts from that is why we exist.
Oakes says his opinion that classes at UH were left-leaning and that he was penalized for his views prompted him to start Proud Boys Hawaii.
Absolutely. The anti-Western propaganda is so thick, anti-American, anti-military. I know Hawaii is especially bad because we have a real activist movement here. I talk to conservative students who do not want to be out about who they are because they fear repercussions, grades in class. That certainly happened to me.
Oakes says Proud Boys are anti-feminist, anti-PC, anti-racist, and pro-guns. They espouse generally libertarian views, glorify entrepreneurs, and venerate the housewife.
Reagan won Hawaii for his second term, and I would very much like, and I do think it's possible for Trump to win Hawaii in his second term, especially with this tax plan. It's good for everybody. I mean, people are going to legitimately see more money in their paychecks in 2018.
5 years later, we won't have that amount of money in our paychecks, though.
Time will tell, yeah. I'm happy so far.
Oakes thinks climate change is a natural process and that mass shootings are statistically irrelevant to the gun debate. I asked if he was involved in an online chat that degraded a Jewish professor.
No, absolutely not.
Would Proud Boys use racial slurs?
No, and none of my guys did.
Proud Boys are known not just for their politics, but for their outfits, black Fred Perry polos. The brand has long been associated with white supremacist groups, though it's disavowed any connection with them or the Proud Boys. Oakes recently started a chapter of Young Americans for Freedom to get more conservative speakers on the UH Manoa campus. Noe Tanigawa, HPR News.
Honolulu Civil Beat's Reality Check this morning features a story by reporter Yu Hyun-jung. She joins us live this morning to talk about the latest spike in COVID numbers in Maui County. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and so we're really concerned about this uptick in numbers there on Maui. And is it fair to say that we can blame the holidays for it?
Well, that's what the state and county health officials are blaming. So I think that it's fair to say that for sure.
And so your article talks about a cluster that broke out at a condo development, a complex.
That's right. So one of the biggest drivers of the current surge on Maui comes from an outbreak at this condo complex in Kahului called Harbor Lights. And we definitely don't want to single out and stigmatize anyone there. But the outbreak has grown to about 92 cases when I checked this morning. And so state officials are providing some wraparound services there. They're doing on-site testing to residents and other people. And they're also doing some cleaning operations and sanitizing. And they're also coordinating with other agencies to provide some food delivery so the residents who are living in that complex don't have to leave.
And your story talks about a possible, holiday choir practice that may have sparked this?
Yeah, so that's what state officials are saying might have led to the outbreak at the Harbor Lights complex, a holiday choir practice from some time ago.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to find out this detail because, you know, if you want to avoid getting the disease, you might want to avoid some of these types of things, right? Choir practice.
Absolutely. But at the same time, though, Harbor Light is also a very crowded living space where multi-generational families live. So that's another thing to consider. So when you're in an environment like that, yeah, you know, that tends to be a virus prone environment.
And Mayor Victorino issued new orders about staying at home. They're really trying to get people to just not go out and minimize the spread.
Absolutely. And also gatherings are limited to 5 people. County meetings are shut down or suspended rather. And bars and restaurants have to close by 10 p.m. So there are new rules in place to kind of limit more spread. But at the same time, you know, Mayor Victorino has said that he is willing to go even tighter with the regulations should the virus increase continue. And what they're saying also from Maui's end is that they're anticipating the numbers to continue to grow till mid to late January until they actually start going downwards because of the nature of the virus.
Well, we saw last year when Maui was wrestling with the outbreak at the hospital there, you know, everybody pretty much, you know, hunkered down and did a good job in flattening the curve. But what, people just maybe got too relaxed?
That is what I heard from my interview with Dr. Michael Shea, who is the chief medical director at Maui Health. His observation was that with folks starting to trickle back in to take vacation on Maui, which there were about 276,000 people since October, he's seen that more people are a little bit more relaxed about washing hands or wearing masks or social distancing. And, you know, it was the holidays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, what have you. So people let loose a little bit. And then, of course, you know, last week there was that big news about Pu'olai Beach, where there was a drum circle and all these people, hundreds of people partying unmasked. And that actually was, the drum circle was a weekly gathering from what I hear. So they shut that beach down.
Yeah. Little Beach, I think, yeah, is what a lot of folks call it. Well, now, we are rolling out the vaccines, but people just really need to keep their distance, wear their mask, wash their hands.
Yeah, so what Dr. Shea is also saying is that the vaccine is not, like, does not make people invincible, especially when only few people have had it, which is the case right now. I'm looking at the data tracker for the state right now. 25,470 people have had their vaccines administered. That's not 70% of Hawaii. So until 70% of the community has had the vaccine, it's not the time to feel so relaxed about the virus.
Okay. All right. Well, we got to flatten the curve. But thanks so much, Yu-Yun.
Thank you for having me.
And that was reporter Yu-Yun Jung with today's Reality Check. Read her story at sybilbeat.org. You know, prior to the pandemic, Blue Hawaiian helicopters flew tours on Maui, Kauai, Oahu, and the Big Island. As with many tourism-dependent businesses, the company had to shut down due to COVID-19. But with Hawaii's pre-travel testing program in place and a new eruption at Kilauea Volcano, flights are on the rise. Quentin Koch is the president of Blue Hawaiian Helicopters. He spoke with the Conversation's Jason Ubai about the helicopter tour business and the look ahead.
2019 was a great year for tourism, and then starting off 2020, coming into March, we all felt the immediate impacts of COVID and the different restrictions put across all the different islands. We quickly reacted to those and brought the business to a halt and furloughed down to the core employees that are able to keep, you know, the brand and the helicopters safe and, you know, training requirements. Once the travel restrictions were opened up in October, we were slowly able to bring back more and more of our team members. Excited to say, you know, every single week we have been able to add additional members back to the Blue Ohana. And we're up to about 33% of our staff, and we really hope that trend continues and we're able to recover in 2021 as tourism starts to pick up.
As you're bringing more folks back on, what tours are available right now?
Currently, we're offering our most popular tours on all the different islands, including the Big Island, where you can view Volcano National Park. We also have a charter program where you can do charter and customized tours, or even move between the islands as you require and request. We also have an exclusive buyout program, where you can buy two seats at the regular price and buy the additional four seats in the helicopter at half price. That allows you to have an own private experience, which has been very popular with our guests.
What kind of numbers can you provide to let people know that what kind of increase you're seeing in demand for your helicopter tours?
You can see the increase just in the number of employees that we brought back. So Originally, we had about 8 employees during the initial shutdown, throughout the peak of the shutdown, and now bringing back over 33% of our staff. That's your mechanics and pilots and your customer service experience people. And you're able to do that and bring back more and more as the volume increases.
So what's your outlook for 2021?
Our outlook for 2021 is optimistic and exciting. We are seeing, you know, new business opportunities with Kilauea. We're exploring different business opportunities across the entire state, just trying to find a way to reinvent ourselves, stay on top of the leading tours and activities for the state, and really be there to support our employees, our community, and our guests, and give them an experience of a lifetime.
Can you go into a bit more detail about that, what opportunities you're looking at?
For 2021, just looking at opportunities of, you know, recovering, and our goal is to get to at least half of our business that we had in prior years, and we're really measuring that by bringing back our coworkers to work. So, you know, when we looked at the different types of metrics to put out there, the most important to the team is to get all of our coworkers back to work, and our goal in 2021 is to do at least half. And that'll be done, you know, supportive, you know, Mother Nature and Madden Pele on the Big Island, offering different tours and products on Maui, opening back our Oahu business. And we're cautiously optimistic that the Kauai business will return with the new resort bubbles and restrictions and 3-day quarantines that have been in place. So lots of upside in 2021, and we do see growth. And that growth means more people back to work.
So for people wanting to take a tour, safety is very important for them and has been an issue in recent years. So what is Blue Hawaiian Helicopters doing to keep people safe?
We have what we call the Only Blue Commitment. We're one of the leaders when it comes to safety and always have been throughout our existence in the Hawaiian Islands. We're the only TOPS member. We're the only FAA-certified safety helicopter company. We do have synthetic terrain awareness for all of our pilots, and they go undergo that training. We do have the highest hours requirements for our pilots and set the standards for the tourism industry, and continue to test and retest our pilots to ensure the safety for our customers. But it really doesn't stop there. Our parent company is an air medical company, and we've taken some learnings from them on how to deal with COVID. So we have new masks that we have our pilots wear, which looks like a Darth Vader mask, but it's an N95 safe mask. We use cleaning supplies on our helicopters, similar to hospitals. It's valid for up to 30 days, but we still clean in between each and every single cleaning. And we ensure that our facilities are spread out socially distanced, and also ensure that they're cleaned regularly to have the most safe experience, not just for our employees, not just for our guests, but to ensure that we protect our community as well.
What would you like our listeners to know about your company and your business?
I'd like the listeners to come and take a ride and take advantage of our 25% Kama Aina discount. One good thing is we've had more Kama Aina this year or in 2020 than we've ever had before. And the same story repeats itself over and over again. They never knew how amazing and how beautiful our islands are from the air. We took some kapunas up, and when they landed, they were crying, and just they were crying with joy of being able to see how beautiful their islands are. So we invite you all to come, take advantage of that discount. And as there's, you know, limited activities and limited things to do with the family, we are definitely an option and invite you to come see how magical the places we call home. I think it's really important that every single tour operator, you know, travel industry partner, really focuses on safety, and that's protecting our employees, protecting the customers that come through our facilities, because if we do that, we'll protect our community. So we're staying lockstep, following the CDC guidelines, following the state guidelines, and just encourage all of our travel partners to do the exact same, as I know they are doing. And that will allow us to safely open up our islands and have a safe travel experience for the guests. And as this vaccine rolls out and more people are able to move about the world, we'll restore jobs and travel to our island, which we're all looking forward to.
That was Quentin Koch, president of Blue Hawaiian Helicopters, talking about the helicopter tour business. For links to their website, go to hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Your Monday Stargazer spotlights exciting news about the Red Planet. HPR's Dave Lawrence and astronomer Christopher Phillips talk about the upcoming rover maneuvers on Mars.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe surrounding our tiny, very troubled planet. And as usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips to guide us through it. We've got him on the line right now. Hey, Chris, welcome back. What is in store this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, Jupiter and Saturn continue to be visible in the western sky after sunset, even though they are moving slowly apart. The moon this week is passing through its new moon phase, and so conditions will be perfect for stargazing.
And I understand we are counting down to an upcoming landing on Mars.
Indeed. Eyes are turned to the Red Planet this week as NASA's Perseverance rover begins a series of maneuvers that will see it land on the surface of Mars on Monday, January 18. The landing spot for the rover is a crater called Jezero, and once there, the rover will look for evidence of past Martian life. But in order to do that, it has to survive a hair-raising entry into the Martian atmosphere first.
Give us the highlights of what's in store for this device as it makes its way there.
Well, the landing will involve a series of maneuvers in orbit first that will position it for a successful descent. Once initiated, a rocket-powered descent system will slow the rover as it plummets through the atmosphere. Now, the capsule has to slow down to a safe speed in order to deploy the parachute.
What is a safe speed?
Well, when Perseverance encounters the upper Martian atmosphere, it will be traveling at around 12,000 miles per hour. The rocket descent system has 400 seconds to reduce this speed down to about 800 miles an hour. It's quite a braking burn.
Wow, so it's coming in at 800 miles an hour.
To begin with, yeah. And then a secondary sky crane will deploy, which will slow down the rover even further.
And when it finally gets there?
Well, hopefully we'll have a nice, gentle drift down to the Martian surface.
And can they control this landing in any way, or is it just sort of winging it?
It's kind of winging it. Basically, because of the light delay between Earth and Mars, which is about 700 seconds, real-time control is impossible. And so the entire approach and landing is automated. By the time we receive the message that Perseverance has begun its descent, the landing will actually be over. So there's no time to fix things if something goes wrong.
It can guide itself and adjust its speed as it needs?
Essentially, yeah. It's quite a smart rover. But landings are unpredictable, and it's very, very far away, so we'll see what happens.
Couple of good points from you there.
One awesome thing about the landing is that the rover will be recording it via cameras and microphones, so we will actually get to see and hear Mars during this incredible descent, assuming it survives, of course.
Well, let's approach it with optimism and hope we're going to be hearing all about it in a positive way on a future Stargazer episode. With you, Christopher Phillips, we appreciate it.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
This morning on our backyard quiz, we look back at the days when the Scenic Express ran from Hilo along the Big Island's Hamakua coast, offering the passengers a chance to feast on spectacular views and sumptuous food as they dined in style and comfort. The railway line was built between 1909 and 1913 to service the sugar mills north of Hilo. The passenger service was a sideline of sorts. The sugar industry was the real economic driver. but it became a real tourist attraction. The express had to cross the streams and valleys along the Hamakua coast that made for some great sightseeing. The trip included dozens of steel trestles and 3,100 feet of tunnels. And that's why it was one of the most costly railways, mile for mile, that had ever been built. We asked you for its name. It started life as the Hilo Railway, chartered in 1899 and reorganized after a 1916 bankruptcy as the Hawaii Consolidated Railway. And no winners today. We stumped you on that backyard quiz. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honolulu Habitat for Humanity's ReStore, a home improvement store and donation center open Tuesday through Saturday from 9:30 to 4. HonoluluHabitat.org.
Coming Saturday, January 16th, it's a virtual Atherton Studio concert featuring Jerry Santos, founding member and lead singer of Olomana. He'll be joined by Kamuela Kimokeo, playing traditional and contemporary Hawaiian music. Hear beloved favorites as well as new songs. This event is just for HPR station members. Sign up at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Did you include any seafood in your holiday feast recently? Well, if you did, you might want to take a closer look at the fish that made its way from the ocean to your table. Recent research conducted by the Marco Lab at UH Manoa indicated that 21% of seafood in Honolulu is actually mislabeled. To break down the startling research, the conversation's Harrison Patino spoke with Associate Professor Peter Marco of the Marco Lab about the findings.
To make a long story short, we found that 21% of the seafood that we purchased in Honolulu was mislabeled. Most of the mislabeling were things like aquaculture species such as swai, for things that might look similar to a fish like that, like mahi-mahi or snapper. Overall, the mislabeling rate, surprisingly, is on the low side for a major metropolitan area, but still one in every five fish that you buy in Honolulu is probably mislabeled.
I would assume that number comes with a bit of a caveat here in Honolulu and in Hawaii because the rate of seafood consumption is a little bit higher.
On the one hand, we expected that we might see relatively low mislabeling here because people are consuming nearly twice as much seafood than compared to populations on the mainland. And so, therefore, they may be more familiar with seafood and more discriminating about different species. So that might be part of it. But also in Hawaii, you have to consider the fact that many of the most popular seafood items, like ahi tuna, are very difficult to substitute for. And that's probably also in part why our mislabeling rates are relatively low.
Now, you mentioned that swai was one of the biggest offenders here. How is that being passed off? Is it just cut into a different shape to appear as though it's a different kind of fish, or is it just passed off fillet and all sold as something else?
No, most of those mislabeled pieces of swai were found in restaurants, and so they're cut into rectangular shapes and probably cooked with a sauce, and so it makes it difficult to distinguish that from what it's actually being sold as. Although that said, I think most kama'aina would have no problem picking out swai from mahi-mahi because of the thickness of the fillet, as well as the firmness of the flesh and the flavor as well. So I suspect most of the mislabeling is potentially taking advantage of tourists that come to Hawaii and are not as familiar with seafood as people living in Hawaii. I think most likely the fact that many of the things that we really like to eat here, like ahi, salmon, manchong, ono, those are very distinctive fish, both flavor and texture-wise. And so I think it's really difficult to pass off substitutes for those, especially with people that know those fish because they live here. And I think that's got to be a big part of it.
I guess the question to ask here is, how are the actual fish cuts identified themselves by the researchers? I mean, was there a bit of sleuthing that needed to be done, or was this done with the cooperations of the restaurants and grocery stores that were selling them?
We would go to restaurants, groceries, and sushi bars and just buy fish like any other consumer, and we make note of what the seafood is being sold as, what its name is on the menu. And then we take a small sample of it back to the laboratory and genetically analyze it to determine what it actually is based on DNA sequences from its mitochondrial genome, for which there are huge databases with which you can find matches and identify the fish that way.
Now, in particular, I saw that 16 different species of fish can be legally sold to sea bass. I mean, my first question is, how is that legal? But my second question is, how is that possible?
That's established by the Food and Drug Administration. And that body has determined that sea bass is an acceptable name for 16 different species that are some kind of sea bass. So those are different species that are closely related, very similar in flavor, quality, price. And so there's lots of species that can be labeled with that particular name.
Obviously, there are a lot of economic implications with this research, but also ecological impacts as well, namely with the sale of critically endangered fish.
Yeah, that was a surprise to find two species that are considered critically endangered by the International Conservation Union. They're on what's called the IUCN's Red List of endangered species. One of them is the European freshwater eel, and another is southern bluefin tuna. Both are listed as critically endangered species, yet they're managing to make their way to our marketplace.
And I'm assuming that these species would be sold as something like unagi or yellowfin tuna, respectively?
The tuna was simply sold as ahi, and the European eels were sold as unagi. So those are examples of cases where seafood names are not sufficiently specific to provide enough information to a consumer to really understand what it is that they're actually eating.
Well, what is it that consumers can do to ensure that their purchase and consumption of seafood is more informed and ethically conscious?
Well, they should always ask what the seafood is and where it came from is a good question. If a seller has no idea where seafood came from, then you should be suspicious about its identity. But be perfectly honest, in these two cases, it's very difficult for a consumer to know what they're eating, because in the case of the European freshwater eel, probably the retailer has no idea that that might be European eel, because these are fish that are caught as juveniles in the Atlantic Ocean and then shipped to other countries in Asia, in Europe, and North Africa, where they're grown in aquaculture facilities. And then they are sent to other countries where they're consumed. And for example, the United States country of origin labeling laws only require that the last country of origin be on seafood that's being imported into the United States. So when somebody imports unagi into the United States from, say, China, it'll simply say freshwater eel, product of China. And there's no way to know that it was actually a European eel in most cases. So it's really difficult in the case of unagi. And so my advice is to choose something else to eat other than unagi.
Now, is this data being passed along at all to legal authorities or environmental protection or education groups to maybe curb the mislabeling of seafood in Honolulu?
So I don't actively pass it on. But in the case of unagi, I have actually made some contacts with Fish and Wildlife potentially look at a collaboration with them, because I know they're very interested in stopping the sale of European eels because it is endangered species and it also has an export ban from the European Union. So it can't be legally exported from the European Union. So it's something I think the United States would like to help stop. So case of unagi, yes. And we're doing a larger study sampling more samples of unagi from throughout the United States to sort of get a better handle on where most of these European eels are showing up.
In the larger picture of sustainability here, when we talk about sustainable fisheries and making sure that we're not overfishing critically endangered cultures of fish, do you see a path forward to bringing these numbers down, or is that just sort of par for the course when we talk about commercial fishing?
I think the best way that we can potentially curb mislabeling and then allow consumers to make informed choices about their seafood, the best way I think we can do that is by requiring more information on labels when you buy seafood. And specifically, seafood should probably be named or labeled with its actual scientific name. If a retailer wants to put any vernacular or common name on a seafood item, that's fine. But if they had to put the scientific name as well, then that would really educate consumers about what they're eating, and they can make associations between the quality of the seafood and the actual name of the species that they're eating. And I think that level of transparency would help force retailers and distributors to market things accurately with those names. So the European Union has adopted the system exactly like that, in which seafood has to be labeled with its Latin scientific name. And you sometimes see that here in the United States. For example, the Costco in Honolulu has at times labeled their seafood with the scientific name. And I think that is probably the best way to get this, is to provide consumers with the most information possible about their seafood, rather than simply only requiring these fairly generic market names, which don't provide enough information for consumers.
That was Associate Professor Peter Marco of the Marco Lab at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. He was talking with the Conversation's Harrison Patino about mislabeled seafood in the Honolulu area. Wraps it up for today. Tomorrow we hear about a program whose mission is to help new farmers. We talk Go Farms. It's a call-in show. We would like to get your feedback. What did you think about the siege at our nation's capital? Caller talkback line 808-792-8217. Tweet us at HI Conversation or head to our Facebook page. And remember, all of our shows are archived. Find them on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We will be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.